If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to counsellor and psychotherapist Peter Mahoney.
A great question I encourage people to ask themselves are the W questions. If you're triggered by something, you read something or a message and you just all of a sudden you've gone from being peaceful to angry, what, where, when, why and who? Great questions to ask yourself.
In this conversation, Peter tells us a little bit about himself and what led him to become a therapist. We also get a deeper insight into therapy, what it is and how we can benefit from it. We talk about the impact the pandemic has had on us and how important it is to mind ourselves and others as we recover from the past year. There's a particular focus on teens and those in their early 20s in this episode. We also tap into self-worth, family dynamics, how friendships have changed during COVID. And he also gives practical parenting advice and shares tips on how to be a better friend to someone who really needs support. This episode was right up my street. I learned so much listening to him, and I hope you do too. Peter, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. I'm loving the fact that this week is quite different in that we only connected on Monday through Instagram. So I threw it out to Instagram that I was looking for a guest this week simply because the person I'd lined up couldn't do it. And I thought, why not throw it out and see what happens? And I got a huge response, which was I was really flattered about. But yours was one of the first that came in, and I was really drawn to it because of what you said that you do for a living and also what you suggested we may discuss. And I thought, that's it. I have actually wanted to record an episode about therapy and COVID. And so here we are. It feels divinely timed.
Absolutely.
For want of a better description. So thank you for making yourself available for this. I feel very lucky.
Thank you.
So Peter, let's start with you as, I suppose, yourself, your own story. You're a married man of, and you have five kids and you're a granddad.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I know. I can't believe it myself. Married young, started family young. So I'm 49. I'm clinging on. I mean, 50th is around the corner, but I'm clinging on. I'm still saying I'm late 40s. And of course, my kids are slagging me saying, no, you're not. But I'm clinging on for the last bit. So I've been married to Kira for 29 years. Childhood sweetheart. We have five kids. Our youngest is 17, just finished the Leaving Cert. Fair play to her. She got through it all. The school were brilliant. COVID, all that. You know, she's there. She's done. And our eldest is now 27. And he's married. And our next daughter then is married as well. So Paul has Eliza. She's 9 months. And she in herself is therapy.
Yeah.
And when she comes over, it's just whatever's going on. She just looks at you. She plays. And it's brilliant. Really, really love it. I do see myself primarily as I'm a husband, I'm a dad, and I'm a counsellor is what I do.
Yeah.
So I see my identity as being a husband and dad primarily. But what I do to help pay the bills or to contribute is counselling and psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love it. I've come to it late in life. Mm. I finished school, and during my summer holidays, I had worked with my dad. He had his own kind of small painting business. So I worked with him during the summers, really enjoyed it. Then I decided when I finished school, I thought I had to go into college because everybody else was, but I knew it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
So my dad says, well, if you want to do this, why don't you get trained properly in it? So I did it 4 years, then started my own business, got married. Then I think around then the interest rates went really crazy. So I ended up doing security work for a year and a half. Well, Kira had a good job in the bank. And then we just started a family young, like really young. So like by 33, I had 5 kids, you know.
Yeah,
it was
wow.
really mad, you know, really, really mad. But great
I know,
fun.
But I mean, it worked for you guys.
That's our story.
Exactly. That's your story. Totally.
Yeah.
And I suppose biologically, you're kind of doing it the right way as well. You're doing it in the time frame you're meant to be doing it.
In some ways, yes. I feel I have the energy for it anyway. So I did that work for 20 years. Absolutely loved it. Really
yeah.
loved it. Small little business I ran myself. Really enjoyed it. But then I had a lot of lower back problems, and about 2015, I just had a real breakdown of the back, is what the doctor called it. And I was getting injections for about 3 years. I was on very strong pain medication, getting back injections for the nerves, everything. And looking back, if that hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't be where I was today. But
yeah.
in the middle of it, it's going, what is going on? I'm self-employed, trying to work, raise a family, feeling like a cripple, really did feel like a cripple. And your world becomes very small. When you're dealing with chronic pain, your world becomes very tunnel visioned, as in just survive the next moment. You can't think wider. So I was having a cup of coffee with some friends one day, and they invited me to do a foundational course in counselling and psychotherapy. And I thought, why not? They invited both Kira and myself. Kira's got a very, very pastoral heart, but counselling is not for her. So I jumped into the 4-day course, and at the end of it, I came home really excited, and there was the offer to do the diploma. And Kira said, I think you should do it. I've not seen you this excited in a long time. I thought, okay, I'll trust her instinct. Did the diploma, started seeing clients, finished that. Between finishing the diploma and starting the degree, we had a bit of a family tragedy where my brother took his own life, and that really threw the summer for us. Mm. It was May 2 years ago, and it just kind of, I had just started my practice and seeing people, and all of a sudden this happened. But it actually hugely shaped my work.
Yeah.
Decided to jump in and do the degree, and for the last kind of 2 years, but 18 months really, I've been running my own private practice. I have my own office, and she had the privilege of being able to sit opposite somebody for an hour and hear their story. I am the lucky one.
Mm.
And the beauty of therapy is that it's not rocket science. It's actually just creating a space where somebody can come and be heard and listen to, and no judgment,
yeah.
Total acceptance for who they are and what they're experiencing. I have had the greatest honor for me is that people sit there and they kind of go, I thought I was going to take this to the grave. And then they tell you what yeah. happened to them or what
unburden
they did,
themselves.
Unburden themselves. And it's life changing.
Yeah, of course it is.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. I had one client who his brother had got in touch with me and had told me he'd been from Billy to Jack to Josephine with all sorts of chronic pain, headaches, migraines, depression, medication. And I was thinking, how am I going to care for this man? So he drove down. It was about an hour and a half, 2 hour drive down to me, and he came weekly. And for the first 4 sessions, he just talked and talked, and he'd sit and he'd kind of rock in the chair, and he put his hands on his head because of the pain. He was going to kind of drink for comfort in the evening after his day's work.
Mm.
And in each session, I'd said about 4 sentences to him, you know, just listen to him, and then, you know, anything else or very little. On session 4, he said to me, can I really tell you anything? And I said, yep. I reiterated our contractual things where I would have to break our confidentiality, but I said, you can tell me anything. And he unburdened some things that he had hidden in his life for years and years.
Mm.
And he sat back in the chair afterwards and said, I feel lighter.
Yeah.
The image he had of himself was a horse pulling a cart with the blinkers on and you know, the mouth muzzled and the whip, and the people on the cart were everybody who had done him harm over his lifetime, from the age of seven over his lifetime. And after he told me a lot of those stories and he felt better, he came back the next week and says, Peter, my whole life is different. He said, the image I have now is I'm steering the horse and the only people on the carriage with me are the good people in my life now. He just flipped his story completely. And Sheila, I said very little.
Well, that's because you're a good therapist. You knew just to sit back and allow the person to open up. And I think, as you said, it's creating a safe space. What my understanding of therapy is that, you know, and it is a trust thing. You have to kind of build trust with the person sitting in front of you. So I think it probably is a two-way street, is it? It's trust for the person coming in to open up and talk about whatever's going on for them. They need to feel like they can trust you. And vice versa, I suppose, for that kind of honesty to present itself. And it's interesting that it did take a few sessions, which I would imagine it's normal. Mm. It's not like you're going to have those breakthroughs in session one. It rarely probably happens for people where you do need to kind of stick with it. But when I met you as well, and I know we can't, you know, make our minds up on first impressions, but I think biologically we're programmed to respond in a positive or negative way. Sometimes we can't help it. You know, the way you instantly meet someone and you instantly maybe go, not so sure, or yes, I like them. I instantly did like you. The second I met you, I went, okay, yeah, class, he's lovely. Lovely vibe, good way about him. So I can imagine that people do feel comfortable in your company as well. Mm. It's interesting when you did touch on the fact that your brother had passed away, and I don't want to dwell on it. Mm. And I am sorry.
Thank you.
And I can only begin to imagine that that has deepened, I suppose, your understanding of people's pain and grief in a huge way.
Oh, absolutely. I remember studying it. It was one of the modules we did. And I was distant to it going, you know, this could, great parents, great family life, you know, all going well. But my brother's pain was quite unique. And I know the root of it now, but I will. We knew he was struggling. We knew he was going through a difficult time, and we all rallied around. But that Saturday morning, that call from my dad, and even today, 2 years on, when I see my dad's number on the phone, there's this, you know, just that moment. It's lessened, but literally, he just said, "Are you sitting down?" And he told me what happened, and I just dropped the phone and burst into tears. And my wife came over, Kira came over and said, "Are you okay?" And she picked up the phone. And 20 minutes, I just broke down. Yeah. And I needed to do that. And then it was kind of, okay, what next? It was, I think suicide in particular is very complicated because what it can leave for those left behind is so many questions that may never get answered. So they talk about the five stages of grief, and it can be, you know, they don't come in order, and it's definitely not, you know, in a circle or in a line. It's very, very confusing. Yeah. I went to anger. 2-3 months I went to anger. And I was snappy at home. I was just angry inside. I was angry at my brother for what he did to my parents, for what he did to us. And I was angry because I didn't understand. Why didn't he talk? Why didn't he reach out? And then you begin to remember he called in. It was this Friday evening he took his life. And I remember coming in on the Saturday night. On this previous Sunday, he called into me. He never called into me. And he sat for about half an hour. And afterwards, I was going, was that his goodbye? You know, you begin to relay all the last interactions you have with them. And then I remember visiting him in an institution that he was in for a little bit and walking with him. And you kind of go, was I too hard on him? Was I too light on him? But at the end of the day, Andrew made his decision. And what we had studied was very, very few people actually want to end their life. They want to end the pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually it. Nobody necessarily wants to die. They just want to end the pain, but it gets so deep for them. This is the only way out. You know, all of my family have gone to different people to talk about this ourselves, different professionals who have helped us in it. My parents have been phenomenal. Like, talk about them supporting us. At the funeral, they both got up and gave a eulogy at the end, and they had the place and us in tears. We weren't expecting it, but Mum always wanted to have a say in something. So it was so something strong that visited us that certainly it has impacted my practice hugely, and that's an area of, in some ways, therapy is, there's a sense of loss for people coming to therapy, that they've either lost a relationship or lost somebody, or there's something missing in their life. There's a bit of grief, and that Absolutely. Can be part of what brings them to. But it's definitely impacted my practice hugely in just, you don't know what's going on in somebody else's life. You can never, ever make a judgment on what's going on in somebody else's life.
Really don't have a clue.
That compassion and mercy piece is absolutely huge. When the person sits opposite me, they might fill in an intake form. They might tell me their story. An intake form gives me a bit of information, and then the person gives me the information live the first 10 minutes. It's very different.
Yeah.
Because they suddenly feel safe to sit there. And yes, building that place of trust and peace and calm for them. I have found, particularly with younger people, they have me sussed within 10 minutes.
Really?
Oh, they just know. They're cute. They just, I like this guy or don't like this guy. So I just need to sit back, create the space, listen, tell me your story, what's going on. But particularly young people will just have you sussed very quick. And I will say to them and say to the parents, look, let them think about it if they want to come back. But they'll know, no, I don't like this guy. Literally, probably by my first 3 sentences, they don't like my accent. They don't like the office I'm in. They don't like, you know, the way I sit. They just, they suss you very quickly. And I love that about them. Yeah. It's brilliant.
It's either they don't like or they do like, as you said.
Absolutely.
And I suppose with grief, as you mentioned there, you know, that's a profound understanding of grief that unfortunately you've been presented with. You had no choice when you got that phone call from your dad. But there are so many different versions of grief, and I think collectively we've been going through a grieving process this entire, I really can't keep track of how many months it is. It's obviously over a year. Is it 17, 18 months?
It would be, March. 17 months.
Yeah. Because we're grieving our lives pre-pandemic, and there's so many different versions of grief where it could be breakdown of a relationship while the person is still alive. They're not in your life anymore, so you're grieving the loss of that relationship or a job or whatever it is. And I don't think there's a person in the world that hasn't been touched by it in one way or another. I think anyone listening to this will appreciate that they've had their own grief and their own, they're carrying their own pain. They might be in a good place now, but we've all had it, haven't we?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Ways.
Oh, absolutely. And it's affected many, many different people in many different ways. There's no one main track. You know, everybody has dealt with this, and it was subtle. It was distant to us pre-Christmas, and it was China, and then it was Italy, and we were all still planning the rugby match.
Yes,
you know, and we're all still planning, you know, kids, their Debs, and all Patrick's Day parties and all these things. So it kind of crept in slowly, and then it was like 2 weeks. We shut the school for 2 weeks, and then so we all thought, grand, two weeks.
We can do
this. A month, that's fine. The weather was nice. The clocks changed. We're all out walking. And it crept up on us. And all of a sudden, it's kind of like, I'm 6 weeks into this. And the whispering of, well, this could be around for a year. This could be around for two. So it kind of snuck up on us. So the novelty was very much at the beginning. Oh, this is great working from home. The kids being at home, the readjustment. Very stressful for some. I know there were some families who had a leaving cert, junior cert on a primary school kid, and parents needing to work, and they were going, primary school kid, you know, we'll buy an iPad for you. You need to share it. And all that stress that went on. IKEA, I think, was empty of all sorts of desks and chairs because everybody was working from home. So it kind of crept up on us. There isn't, you're right, Sheila, there's not one person who's not been impacted by this, whether they know it or not. And maybe the impact might now actually come out afterwards. They may have survived. I think as humans, people have sat opposite me and they have dug deep into every resource they've had as a person or a human being to get through this. You know, their patience, their resilience, the patience with themselves or with others, the readjustment to working from home, the readjustment of getting kids through school, the losses of businesses. Like some people have had to dig incredibly deep to find new resources that we never thought we had. And as I said to you, what has happened to the human being, and more importantly, well, the human race, but more importantly, the human being over the last 17, 18 months, completely abnormal. Abnormal to isolate yourself. You know, don't be in touch with me. The way I was hearing the message was, presume other people are infectious.
That's right.
And I was kind of going, That's an interesting slant on it. I know why they're saying it. I want to be very respectful to the people who have cared for us through this whole time, but it was almost like an element of fear. You know, presume the person opposite you will make you sick. So we all very, very suspicious of each other. We're not used to that. We're used to the, especially the Irish, the nod in the supermarket, the laugh, the crack, and stuff. But our reactions to it have increased anxiety, isolation, breakdown of relationships. Those things have been, our reactions to them have been incredibly normal.
Yeah. And really I actually heard somebody speak recently about the term social distancing, how they would have preferred if they had used physical distancing rather than social distancing, because, as you said, we are social creatures and we need it. It's important. And even if you can't physically reach out and shake somebody's hand, you can give them a smile. Absolutely. Even if you're wearing the mask, you smile with your eyes. There are ways of communicating, because it goes against the way a lot of us are wired. Mm. I've certainly struggled through the time, but it's amazing when you look back at, we've just gone through so much. Mm. As you said, fear has been a huge player for a lot of people. Some people have come out the other side of that. Some people are maybe still in it and are feeling that anxiousness and that, I suppose, apprehension of what the future holds. So it's so layered and it's so different for everyone. But as we are in a better place now, obviously, with the vaccine rollout and the amount of people getting COVID and the numbers in the hospitals are way down, which is fantastic. You know, things are looking up, but it almost feels like, because we have been in the survival mode for so long, that it's now that a lot of people need assistance, need help adjusting, coming out the other side, because I suppose you're in that protective. Would I be right in thinking the body is in the kind of protective zone of survival, get through, get through. I'm strong. I can get through this. But now you need time to breathe. Mm-hmm. And when you reassess, you realize the toll it's taken on your life.
Absolutely. Our brains, the main function of our brains is to protect us. Yeah. Not so much for the learning and taking in information and, you know, sorting it out and then regurgitating it. The function of our brain is to keep us safe. So our brains have been on hyper alert to keep us safe, which means while that is doing that, we've probably had to shut down an emotional part of ourselves just to get through. So we've not been as emotionally aware. In some ways, we've not been as attentive to what is really going on inside of us, because our brains have gone, keep safe, what's next, readjust. And now that the brain will begin to open up again and go, okay, we can feel safe again, the emotional overflow will come out. Can I just say, I would imagine for some people have excelled in this restrictive time.
Yeah.
They have, entrepreneurs have done really, really well. People who have dug into those resources have really turned their life around. Those who were struggling have gone, this is an opportunity for change. So there's a cohort of the population who have really thrived. And I take my hat off to those people who saw the opportunity, went for it, took a chance, bought the van, opened the window and sold coffee or whatever, readjusted, going, okay, I can do business there. I admire people who can make that change in time of real despair. So I think they should be acknowledged.
Absolutely.
As much as those who have really struggled at this time.
Yeah.
I think for what I see a lot of kind of 16 to 25 year olds. That's a huge chunk of my of the people who I'm privileged to see. And their brains are still forming. Until you're about 25, your brain is still in a development stage and an emotionally developmental stage. So there's been an interruption for them in this. Is this being kind of curveball thrown in for them? So there's a lot I would really, really, particularly that population. The older generation, we've maybe been able to come out of this a bit more. I've seen my own parents and parents-in-law be happy with isolating themselves and now feel so much better with the vaccination. They're coming in and out of our house, they're talking to the neighbors again, and they're doing okay. For younger people with this interruption in so much part of their lives, the only way I can describe it for that cohort is they've been robbed.
Yes.
Literally call the guards, because they have been robbed of so many experiences. Some of them finished the Leaving Cert online and then jumped into a first year in college online and have been missed out on all. Now, I'm not talking about the mad nights out, just the whole social change that goes on. For 14 years, it's school. 8 to 2 or 8 to 4, homework, junior cert, Leaving Cert. Your life is very organized. And then all of a sudden you're swept into this a lot more autonomy. If you show up for the lecture, great. If you don't, you've missed it. You know, handing in the assignments, getting the college work done, finding a job, you know, moving abroad, staying at home. It's meant to kind of launch you out into life in a real positive way. And there's been a stunt in that.
Yeah.
Some people still feel, even though they're in maybe finished second year of college or first year, they still feel like they're in school.
Yeah,
they haven't had that experience, and I really, really feel for that age group.
And they are the years when you are out socialising.
Yeah,
you know, it's when you're having fun and you're exploring and you're curious about the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny that I spoke to Professor Luke O'Neill last year, and he pretty much said exactly what you said, that the most vulnerable ages mm-hmm. Would be the late teens, early 20s in this whole thing. And
absolutely.
It makes sense, because I suppose we live life in chapters as well, and we're different phases in our lives. Like, my little boy is nearly 4, and I'm sure it probably has impacted him in some way,
mm-hmm.
but in the main, he's very content because he's had a lot of his mom and dad at home, which is great. And he's kind of adapted pretty seamlessly because he's young.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I can only begin to imagine myself at 18, 19, if this had been the way it was, like, God, I don't know how that would have impacted me.
It's
important to kind of think that way, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's really important for us, either as parents or as support people for this age group, get into their shoes.
Yeah.
Walk a month in their shoes. I see it regularly during the week, what they are experiencing. But get into their shoes. My daughter's a teacher down in Waterford with her husband in the same school, which is very interesting. Any man who walks into the classroom, they all think that's her husband, which is very funny because they share the same school. But she has said that kids are of that age are incredibly resilient. They will bounce back. If there's been a gap of 6 months or a year, they'll catch up. Mm. You know, so if it's an encouragement to any parents of children that age, don't worry so much for them. They will be able to catch up, and they have plenty of time to catch up. Out of all that the older teenage, early 20s have been through, I see it, the biggest impact is not so much on their education, not so much on their emotional life, their friendships. It has decimated some friendships because for some they have been told, either they've been told by, you know, the people in charge, isolate, you know, you be distant. And then by family members, depending on what's going on, you absolutely can't go away, you absolutely can't do this. And then others are a bit freer about that. And what I'm seeing a lot in that age group is teenagers coming in or college age kids coming in, and the biggest thing that they're feeling is isolated from their friends.
Yeah.
And the thing of their friends, seeing a group of friends going out and them not included. And this article in the Irish Times there recently was a transition year. Students did this kind of study on social media and friendships. And it was unbelievable, some of the information that has come out, that how relationships are now being done. But the pandemic has made it worse, that over social media, boyfriends, girlfriends and friends of both sexes have been saying, you're not to see this person. You're not to go out with that group. You're not to wear that. Block this person on your phone. It's become crazy, the behavior between them. And they think it's normal behavior. Mm. Or this is how you do relationships. But it's not actually.
Yeah.
It's really not. So my heart is going out to those people, that particular age group, because they are, how do I do friendship now? I've missed a lot of maybe first year in college or half first year and all of second year. And I'm meant to be making choices for, you know, Erasmus years or exchanges. And how do I do? And all that uncertainty. So I really, really feel for that. I think it's been their relationships and their close relationships. That whole ground has been shaken on them. And how do they readjust coming back out? How are they going to do friendships again? Because people have withdrawn and are now moving either towards a smaller group of people, and people are being left behind. So I would encourage any teenager who are listening to this, just be big-hearted, not small-minded.
Yeah.
You know, think of those who have been in your circle. They might need you, but they may never say it.
Yeah, and often it is the ones that won't say it that need it the most. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You touched on it there, and I think it's a huge one as well, is dynamics, family dynamics, your relationships with friends, and how I have spoken to a lot of people who feel like not alone, relationships within their own family, be it siblings or parents, have changed during the time, or with friends that some have come into their lives, some maybe drifted away, depending on sometimes for no reason other than the disconnect, the isolation. But also then there's the, I have this opinion about the now and my pal has a different one, and we just can't connect, and we just we argue or whatever it is. So that's a huge strain on people as well. And it can create a lot of tension within families and within friend groups when people have such differing opinions. And it's very hard if you are at one end of the spectrum and you're speaking to somebody who has a completely polarizing view to you. Isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. What the pandemic done for individuals and say the dynamic of the family is that because we'd be rushing in the morning and getting kids out to school or going to work and then coming home and meals and then, you know, the Gaelic, the football, the ballet, the swimming, the soccer. We were all the time moving. So and it was fine. It was all working okay. All of a sudden, we were forced into this, everybody in your own four walls. And the way I would describe it is that any of our own personal or family unresolved issues had a chance now to come to the surface. Because, you know, you never noticed how that person brushed their teeth, but all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, it's like your fingers down a chalkboard. Because you're around it 24/7, all of a sudden you notice that, you know, they're on a device far more than you thought they were. So our own personal issues of how we interact with people, anything that may have been unresolved for us had an opportunity to come to the surface. Hence why some families really did struggle through the pandemic. They really did not know how to operate in this space of being literally thrown together, because there was the distraction of the, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that. Equally, I know it did give some families great opportunities to connect and to kind of go, let's play board games, let's, you know, have a night where it's just the candles in the house and, you know, we tell stories and, you know, all of a sudden like coffee dates with dads and daughters, mums and sons, dads and sons, all those things. So there were a lot of good did come out of it. But for those who've really struggled, I believe it's those unresolved things in our life all of a sudden had a chance to come to the surface. The painful memories, a bit of the trauma, the things that we were ignoring, we couldn't ignore anymore. Some have done really well and gone, there's an issue, I want to sort it out. And some others, it's taken its toll either on their marriage or their relationship or with their kids. Yeah. I know one centre that I work from, there is a 5-week waiting list for families. For families to come, that's huge for our society. Because I'm thinking, okay, I might see this child, a teenager, for an hour, but for the rest of the week, they're back in this dynamic that may not be very healthy for them, or maybe kind of quite emotional or emotive, and it's very difficult for them. It can be very hard for them to compute and live in that kind of tension all the time. So it's been relentless.
I might be veering off because I know family therapy is not your area of specialty, but it does fascinate me that, you know, a lot of people individually go for therapy, which is a wonderful thing. Anyone going for therapy, I think, is a very positive thing. But as you said, particularly say with a child or somebody who has, has an issue or something that's causing them pain of whatever type, and they come and discuss it and they have a really good session, but then they're going back into that environment that could be reactivating all that kind of stuff again. Yeah. So unless, I suppose, the family decide to look at it as a whole and decide to accept and you know, hear the other person's point of view and activate change that way, it's...
Well, Sheila, you're absolutely on the money.
It's probably quite frustrating, isn't it?
Because there's a set of parents who almost drive up, chuck the kid in the door and go, fix them, and then I'll be back in an hour. And you're kind of going, okay, I can do my best, but for a rule that I have for any under 18 I see, I do not see them until I have a parental session, either with mum and dad or mum or dad.
Oh, very good.
I have to see the parents first. Now, that consultation could be done over the phone because I know parents are very busy. It's better face-to-face because they get a sense of me before they hand the care of their child over to me and I get a sense of them. And there are cases where you actually end up just working with the parents and you never see the child. Because the parents go, you ask the parents, well, they focus on their child, he's doing this, he's doing that, or she's upset, or she's very quiet, she's withdrawn, or she's acting out. But then you begin to discuss the dynamics of the family with the parents. Well, you know, what's your work schedule like? What's your downtime like? Do you get time as a family? Do you have meals together? Are they shoved from Billy to Jack all day? You know, and all of a sudden the parents, well, there's this happening, that. Well, would you try this for a week and see how it goes? Okay. So sometimes with the dynamic, particularly for the under 18s, you are wise to do the parental first, and then maybe do a few sessions with the child, and then bring the parents back in again. Always open communication back, and that's laid out right from the beginning. Everybody, the child knows. Yes, I have a confidentiality contract with the child, but they know that I am also going to be speaking with mum and dad, but nothing that I would say to mum and dad will be a surprise to the young person. And mum and dad know that I will be in touch with them. They can be in touch with me. It has to be multiple people involved in it rather than just the child come when you fix them and send them home. So you're absolutely on the money. It's not just get the person in and try and do the work with them, because what they're going back to, there has to be change in the whole family dynamic of what's going on.
And sometimes people like to point the finger, don't they, and blame and say it's their problem. I remember a friend of mine said a brilliant thing to me once about that. You know, he said, when you're pointing your finger, how many fingers are pointed back at you? And I was like, oh yeah, that's actually brilliant. Right, okay. Yeah. So what part have I played in this? Because it's easier. It's easier to pass the buck, isn't it? It's easier to say, he or she did that to me, rather than saying, well, what perhaps brought that about, or what part did I play in that? And it's hard. And like I'm still at 42 feeling like I have so much work to do myself. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've done a fair bit, but there are so many times in my life when I feel like I fall back into old conditioned behaviours that are not necessarily good for me or for those around me. And I just feel like, wow, I'm here again. I'm here again. Did I not learn the lesson? So therapy fascinates me.
Absolutely.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's brilliant. I think everybody can benefit from it. I haven't actually been to therapy for over 10 years, but I'm going back and I'm looking forward to it because I feel like I need a little bit of TLC at the moment. And I'm excited because I feel like it's been quite the break and I perhaps shouldn't let it go as long as I did. I did it for quite a period in my life when I was going through, as you said, a different type of grief. I was grieving my old life pre-cancer. I had cancer, I went through a breakup and lost a job in about a year.
Wow.
And it was hardcore. And I felt very broken and lost, and therapy was hugely beneficial to me. Like, I don't know if I'd be here today if I didn't have therapy. I don't mean that in a dramatic sounding way. What I mean is I don't think I'd be the person I am having this conversation with you had I not done the work on myself and all that it brought about in my life. So I really do see the value of it. But for somebody listening who is a bit like, oh, therapy, really? I don't know how I feel about it. Or I'm curious, but I've never done it and I'm a bit afraid of it. You've just explained quite a lot already. You've already said that as a therapist, often you can just sit there and say very little and allow the person to speak. But yeah, in your own words, how would you describe what therapy is?
Oh, jeepers. Well, fair play to you for doing that. I really admire you, Sheila, for taking that step and doing that because you bore fruit in your life because of it.
Yeah.
And now you know, okay, bit of pruning might be needed so that more fruit could be born again.
Absolutely. I'm just feeling I'm midway through my pregnancy. I'm going to have a little girl and I just feel like there's something big happening and I feel like I need to make peace with some stuff and learn. So I'm not carrying that forward into the next generation. I know it sounds a bit cryptic, but I just feel like there's a bit of bit of cleansing necessary or something.
Absolutely.
So I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to doing it. I know probably won't be easy all the time. That's the thing about therapy. When you start delving deep and you start looking at yourself, it's not always pretty.
Yeah.
It's not always enjoyable, but it's very worthwhile.
If you trust the process
and
see the long game, and again, I would say this to a lot of young people, we are a society driven by, I can have it now. I can order something tomorrow and pretty much have it tomorrow the next day, maybe from anywhere in the world. So there's this immediacy that's there for me, convenience. Sometimes the inner journey, the inner work, you just need to see the long game. I think after two sessions, I'm not really feeling any better. I'm not anywhere, you know, I'm just talking. Trust the process. I'm reading a fascinating book at the moment, Dr. Perry and Oprah Winfrey wrote it, and
I haven't read that yet.
It's been mind opening for me. And
what happened to you, isn't it?
Yeah, what happened to you? So, because so many people come in and go, "What's wrong with me? I'm socially anxious. What's wrong with me? I'm depressed. What's wrong with me?" That's not the question to ask. It's what happened to you. So, Sheila, what happened to you? Well, I had cancer and I lost a child and lost my job. That's what happened to you. There's nothing wrong with you. Mm. You had this put on you. You didn't go looking for any of these things. They happened to you. And therefore, the things that happened to us, we put a meaning on it. So a personal example from my own life that I really found beneficial in therapy was my mantra, negative story in my head was, no matter what I did, it wasn't good enough. Okay. I took that into my 20, into my marriage, into my fatherhood. I was kind of like, no matter what, in the background, no matter what I do, it's not good enough. And that came about from the ages of 13 to 18. Football was my life. Absolutely. I played football 24/7. I loved it. Dream of going to England never happened. There was thousands of me in Dublin who were just as good at playing football, but the dream was get there. But the role of a coach or mentor is absolutely huge. And from my very first game to my last game, hundreds of games from, I was a forward. My very first game from, we were 1-0 down at halftime. We came out at halftime. I scored the two goals. We won the game 2-1. Back into the dressing room, nothing said to me. My first game, I got the winner. It was kind of like, as a 14-year-old, you're thinking the coach come over, you're brilliant. Nothing.
Okay.
And that's how it went. Now, the assistant manager was very vocal and well done and everything, but for me, the top guy didn't say it. So, as a young boy growing up, I go, no matter what I do, it's not good enough. No matter how well I play, it's not good enough. And you take that then into some of your relationships now, and you become maybe a people pleaser, or you overcompensate and you do too much for people, or you're always available, because the question inside of me, Peter, was, no matter what I do, it's not going to be good enough. So if I keep doing, one day I might be good enough.
Yeah.
And it was my great wife and our kids and being a dad and then mentoring, you know, voluntarily with others, that, and going to my own therapy and needing to realize as I filled in some questionnaires, the thing was, you know, failure to achieve, or, you know, I was going, oh, yeah, that's me. I grew up as a kid thinking I hadn't achieved. So I needed to change that mantra in my head. And all of a sudden I humbly, and the right part of our ego can go, I try and be the best husband. I try and be the best dad. I will try and be the best there. I won't please everyone. I'll try and be the best friend. But I'm no longer haunted by that mantra of, no matter what you do, it's not good enough. I will do my best. And whoever sits opposite me for that hour, they will get the best of me. And my child, if they comes in, will get the best of me. So therapy offers the opportunity for us to tell our story. What happened to you? Yeah. I was neglected. I was abused. I was, bullied. I was sick. I lost, you know, this person. That's what happened to me, because that happening meant I put a meaning on it. It could be, I can't trust the world. A person suddenly dies in you. I experienced that. Don't tell me everything's going to be okay, because when this happened to me, when I got the phone call about Andrew, I could not trust the world going, well, what's next? If this can happen to me, anything. And I needed just to work through that. Now I trust the world again. Yeah, and I trust life again, going, okay, I'm okay now. I was not for months. So coming in and sitting opposite somebody allows you to be a witness to your own story, and allows somebody else to be a witness to your own story. And hugely important is for you to have your experience and your feelings validated.
Yes, be seen.
Oh, I had a guy, first session with him the other day, and he was telling me his story, and he had been with a partner. She became pregnant, and about 4 months in, stillbirth, and it was gone. This happened 7 years ago. Yeah. And I just looked at him and said, I'm really sorry, dear. That must have been so hard.
Course.
The tears came. 7 years later, he's not even with this person. You know, they don't see each other, but that still lives on. So there's still a message inside of his head somewhere of pain for him. Yeah. So that's what therapy can allow. If you're curious, try it out.
try it out. Yeah.
Try. The personal recommendation is always the better one, rather than just maybe the Golden Pages. You know, it's our an online directory. If you can get somebody who can recommend somebody, is always the best. But if you just, if there's a, I had a guy come to me 3 weeks ago. And he'd watch a TV show, a documentary about four guys who were telling their story of mental health. A very, very good story. It was on one of the social media platforms, the news platforms. And I watched it myself. A friend of mine directed it and it was brilliant. I got a phone call from this guy going, I watched that show. I know there's something not right. Can I come and see you?
There you go.
Now, he doesn't know yet what's going on. Yeah. He's telling me his story of the relationship with his dad, the relationship with his mum, his struggling trying to decide his next college course and the pressure of everybody going, what's next? What's next? What's next? And he's like, I don't know. But he knows there's something not right. But because of this, he's kind of like, I'm not fine. I might need to go. We might only have 3 or 4 sessions together.
Yes.
And that's fine. For some, it could be I'm seeing some people for a year on and off. And that's okay. Yeah. There's no rhyme or reason to this. But I always leave it back with the other person. If you want something next week, let me know.
Yeah.
Would you like to book something in? But it has to be their journey. And some people come for one and then they don't come back. And then they check in 6 months later.
Sure.
And things like that. So if you think there's something going on or not sitting right with you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Reach out. A great question I encourage people to ask themselves are the W questions. If you're triggered by something, you read something or a message and you just all of a sudden you've gone from being peaceful to angry, what, where, when, why and who? Great questions to ask yourself.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think now in society, and I even do it myself with the podcast, I give people a warning at the beginning of what the conversation contains, because I think it's important to prepare people in advance so that they're not unnecessarily traumatized or upset by listening to something that they weren't maybe expecting. Mm-hmm. But in saying that, I think we're sometimes, and this may sound harsh, and I'm extremely aware of it myself, but I think sometimes we allow ourselves to be overly triggered by things, as in there's a refusal to look at it. But I do think, and I've always thought that way, that when something is irritating me, it's not easy, but I do try and say, why? What is it about this person or this situation that is annoying me? Because it's obviously something within myself that needs to be looked at. And that sometimes is hard for people to do, and they just want to block or move on. And you have to do what's right for you in that particular moment. But sometimes if you can look beyond that and delve into it and discover why, it really has nothing to do with that other person or the thing that you're watching that is annoying you. It's something within yourself that it's showing. It's just, it's irritating because it's something you want. It could be jealousy or it's a lack or whatever it is. It's fascinating stuff, I think, when you delve into that. Just going back to what you said there about being a kid, because I'm just imagining you as a 13 or 14 year old, and you've had such a brilliant match and you've played brilliantly, and as you said, you're hoping and you're waiting for this recognition from from the boss and you don't get it. Isn't it amazing how something that in a relatively short space of time, and that person probably didn't even think of it, could stay with you and sow the seed of doubt of your own self-worth. And it's something I'm extremely passionate about speaking about myself, because I've always struggled with my own feelings of being enough. Like, always. People who really know me say, God, you say sorry a million times a day. And I do think it's something I'm still working on as a 40-odd-year-old woman, that I over-apologise for myself. And it comes from a lack of feeling like, well, I'm not good enough. I still have to discover where exactly it comes from, because I had very encouraging parents growing up and all that kind of stuff. But it's amazing how it can be something as apparently small, but it's huge. It's huge. And I think as kids, a lot of us are, we operate and I suppose perform on praise and acknowledgement. It's that old Irish saying, Mull an oigis tuchishe, you know, and if we don't get it or we're not seen, it just allow us to kind of shut down.
Oh, absolutely. It could be a mum and dad could be the best, but we could live in the shadow of another sibling. Or I know there's the classic middle child, oldest child, youngest child, you know, the family ranking, I get that. But you can feel in the shadow of somebody else, and therefore your self-worth is not good. Can I say that there's a window of tolerance, there's a healthy part of wanting to please people and being other-centred and caring for them. You know, it's a beautiful characteristic traits to have, to be aware of other people and other-centred and willing to serve and do what you... There's a healthy part of that. The bit we need to concentrate on is, when does it not serve me well? When does it shut me down, or when are we into overdrive and I'm burnt out? If I keep going this way of always answering my boss's call at 10 o'clock, always doing that, that bit is not serving me well. So there's a tolerance level where it's okay to you know be driven and to work or to serve others or to be other centered. As long as it's not having such a negative impact on our lives, as long as it's not burning us out or making us resentful, or we're not getting a refill into our own emotional tanks. So just watch that scale for people, because they can. I'm wondering if there's something wrong with me because I am such a generous person. Don't ever stop being generous, but just make sure why, where, when, who, and how. You know, what are those things coming up for you? Coming back for, you know, a huge part. And this is an encouragement to parents, and dare I say even to fathers, a huge piece for fathers is to affirm the character of their children. It is unbelievable. Both parents doing it, but there's something about a dad, statistically, where he affirms the character of the child. Some people do grow up going, my parents love me because I did well in this exam, or because I'm good at a certain sport, or because of my achievements. If parents could really affirm their child's character, they will blossom. You will equip them to take on the world. So it's not, I love you, son, because you're great at rugby, or I love you, sweetheart, because you're in the ballet, or whatever it might be. That's the cherry on the cake.
Yeah.
But I noticed you did that for your sister. Well done, son.
Yeah.
But to affirm the character of our children would actually obliterate a lot of the other negative stuff in their life and actually equip them for what they face in the world. And that's the other piece, Sheila. It is relentless being a teenager at the moment. You know, that thing I touched on earlier about the social media and who you can and can't be with. It is relentless being a teenager at the moment, because there are unbelievable pressures on you to fit in, to act a certain way, to look a certain way, to be in a certain grouping, to do certain sports or not, to look a certain way. It is just relentless. And it's 24/7.
Yeah.
It's 24/7. And I would have others who are flicking through Instagram or TikTok and they're seeing what everybody else is doing and they're not involved in it, or they're thinking. My daughter introduced me to TikTok about 6 months ago and I was flicking through it. It's the best way to waste 15 minutes if you've 15 minutes to waste. But all of a sudden, half an hour later, I'm still on it. But all of a sudden in my mind, I was going, if I want to be successful, I should be doing videos. I should be doing these videos on therapy. Hold on a minute. But I as an adult can maybe get to that point. For teenagers, because their brains aren't fully there yet, they're just caught in this wave of relentless pressure.
Comparison as well.
Oh, absolutely huge. Just going back to the parents, the parents can really pour solid cement into the esteem and value of our, in a good way, of their children by affirming who they are.
I love that. Them. Yeah, acknowledging their talents and their the essence of who they are rather than based on how they look or what they do. Because I think often we, you know, our compliment on how we look are things like, yeah, whether you were good at music or whatever. And that really is not who you are. There are things you can do, and but they're not the essence of your being. So I'm learning from you. I'm going to take this home. I'm already, because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, what kind of mother am I with my little boy? And it's good to be reminded, and it's good to want to do better and not assume that you have it nailed down and you have it sussed, because I think becoming a mother for me has been the most humbling and transformative experience of my life. And I've learned that it's not just about me anymore. And and that is it's brilliant. It's sort of terrifying too, but but it's fantastic. And but the desire to want to be better, a better person, has never been stronger than it is now, because I am a parent and because I know what the impact it can have from different people I know, from their own situations growing up or whatever their dynamics are, that if they're not seen or spoken to in a certain way, that it can have long term impact. And I suppose I want to do the best I can. Just back to dynamics again. I would love if you could give your own advice as a therapist as to how we can be better pals to each other during this time, simply because a lot of us are having such different experiences of the now, and within you know, the backdrop of COVID, we can be going through a lot, be it work pressures or relationship pressures or anything else in between. How can we be a good friend to somebody who comes to you with a problem? I say this as somebody who often I think we want to fix somebody's problem. And, you know, especially if we love and care for them, we don't like to see people in pain. And that sometimes, while it's well-intentioned, can come out wrong, because it kind of can come out as, oh no, you're fine, you know, no, it's all okay and don't worry about it. And actually the person is like, what? I just want to tell you how I feel.
Absolutely. No, it's a great question. And I'd approach it from, let's say you're a parent and then let's say you're a friend. So from a parent's point of view, seek to listen to your child's heart. And what I mean by that is maybe what they're not saying. Maybe be aware of how they are acting or how they are interacting with those others. A parent knows their child and know how they work. And if you see something off kilter, don't ever be afraid to ask your child, how are you doing? Don't ever be afraid to ask them, to take a moment with them and find out just how are they doing. You can do that casually and informally, or you could make it a date. You know, let's go up to and get a drive through meal and just have a chat with each other. If a father and son want to do it, men generally do things better shoulder to shoulder. Face to face is confrontational for a man. Shoulder to shoulder is united and working towards each other. So you'll have a father and son, might be watching a rugby match, and a grunt and a groan and a bit of a chat. That's safe, easy communication, father-son. Mother and daughter might sit down, hands on the, you know, and she tell me what's going on, and they want to see the facial reaction. Now, I do not want to be stereotypically, you know, pigeonholing people, but generally, a man sees face-to-face as being confronted. We're shoulder-to-shoulder, we're in this together. So, two mates, our father and son, dropping him to training. How's school? How's your school friends going? Offer to bring the school friends, because you get gems of information as to what's going on in school or the rugby team or the soccer team in that. So from a parent's point of view, shoulder to shoulder, face to face, never be afraid to ask your child if you think they're struggling. so that they know, even if they don't answer you then, they know mum and dad are open to me answering that question sometime.
And it's so important to be asked, isn't it? How are you? And really ask and wait for the answer.
Yeah, yeah. How are you? Is there anything I can do for you? Anything dad and myself can do for you? You doing okay?
Yeah.
And ask and then leave. Ask and withdraw. Because sometimes they're still trying to work it out in their own brain, but they know the opening is there. Mm. And you can leave it maybe for a few hours or a day or two and go, bye, everything's still okay. They know, right, mum and dad are available. If I need them, that's fine. Teenagers will probably go to their friends group first, but if your teenager comes to you, now this is a lesson we learned very quick. We'd be, you know, finishing a TV show, it'd be 10:30, 11:00, we'd be ready to go to bed. The teenager will come down to say goodnight or come in. They will choose the time they want to tell you. And whether it's convenient for you or not, you put everything else down and you listen to them at that point. If it's 1:00 in the morning or if it's 11 o'clock at night and you are wrecked and have had a long day, if that's the moment, particularly your teenager decides to let you in, don't shut it down. If at all possible, engage with them. Mm. Because if you say, look, can we pick this up actually in the morning? Gone. They'll be in a different headspace in the morning. So if they come to you and are ready to talk and be available at 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night or at a time that's not really convenient for you, don't miss that opportunity.
Yeah.
Don't miss that opportunity. That would be my encouragement to parents. And my encouragement to young people is don't be afraid to approach your parents. Or if you feel that they're really, really are unapproachable, approach somebody. It might be an aunt or an uncle or maybe even a cousin, but don't keep it inside of you, if at all possible. Within the group friends, the other thing about, this could be for the parents or for the friends, is if the person says, I'm struggling or I'm really finding it hard or I'm very low and they can't articulate it properly, don't dismiss it.
Yes.
Absolutely don't dismiss it. Some people can be, look at the people down the road, aren't we better off than them? And all of a sudden they will shut down and you've lost them. You could lose them and potentially do a bit more damage.
Yeah.
So don't minimize what they're feeling, but equally don't go into hyperdrive and go, you're feeling a bit low. Right. Medication, GP tomorrow, into a therapist. It's like, just hear them out.
Yeah.
So just listen.
There's nothing worse than that feeling that somebody says, well, at least you are not like such and such. And you're kind of going, all right, so this thing that's really causing me suffering or upset is now not worthy enough of attention because it's not as bad as Joey down the road or whatever it is. It is damaging. You may already tell. I've been at the other side of that and it bloody hurts.
Oh.
It hurts when somebody you love says to you, well, it's not as bad as such and such. You're like, what?
You're hearing, I'm not important. What I'm feeling is not important. You're a bit of a nuisance. You're so ungrateful. You're hearing all those messages when somebody dismisses what you're feeling.
Yeah.
It takes the wind out of your sails and actually can set you back more. And therefore, if this is the reaction from a primary caregiver or a parent, why would I go to a stranger? They could make that conclusion. I'm shutting this down. I'm not opening them because this might be in the one moment they decided to be brave and approach you. And if you can take it, take it. Among the friends, the thing that comes to mind, you get two guys or two girls and they're all sitting down. What I'd watch out for would be the biases of a friend. And what I mean by that is, I'm really struggling. I just don't feel pretty. I don't feel great about myself. And the other friend as well, I don't want you to ever feel prettier than me because I'm already struggling myself. No, you're fine. You're gorgeous. You look great. And the friend will give the advice from the friend's point of view rather than from what I mean by the bias point of view is that they will. It'll be influenced by the dynamics of the friends.
Yeah.
Did you understand?
Very interesting.
The guys might be a little bit like you'll get a loud response to something because he'll be basing it on his 16 years of life experience or 18 life years of experience. I know we go to friends for advice and I get that. But if it's really deeper stuff, of course, they can be confidence for us. They can be friends and supporters through it. But if it's real deeper stuff you're going through, that would be the time to kind of maybe step into the more professional services that might be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does that sit okay? I friends are so important, but they can sometimes not always be necessarily the best place for teenagers because there's so many different dynamics going on. And the thing that a lot of what's happening with teenagers at the moment is it's not necessarily related to therapy, but you find mates making a plan to go, okay, we'll meet up on Friday at 6 o'clock. A general theme for a lot of young people at the moment is they won't commit until the very last minute unless a better offer comes in. Well, there's only two of them going there, but there's six people going to this better party. All of a sudden at 5:30, they've gone to this party and they'll drop these people here. That's a huge, huge dynamic with young people. They won't necessarily on Wednesday commit to something on Friday necessarily because yeah. they might go, just in case there's wind that something better might come. I don't want to paint them in a bad way because I don't think they're even doing it on purpose. It's more just that's what everybody's doing at the moment. If you're going to be a friend, be a person of your word. Be true to your word. If you've made an arrangement with a friend, stick with it and go through it, even if what seems like a better offer comes up. If a friend approaches you, be honest with them and go, that sounds quite serious or that sounds quite heavy. I'd walk the road with you. I'll be a friend. But would you consider maybe talking to somebody else about that? Or even offering them, look, I'm here. You know, I'm always here for you. But I wonder, should you get more help on this? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Moving away from the teenage age group, just for a moment, say 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, beyond.
Yeah.
When somebody has come to you with a problem and in your head you're going, I have no clue how to respond.
Mm.
Like they're telling me something. And obviously we're not trained therapists.
Of course. The
majority of people. Mm-hmm. When somebody comes to you with something big or they need to unburden themselves, they want to tell you. I mean, it's a privilege that they've come to you, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
It's a compliment to you that they want to open up. They want to share something with you. But if you in your head silently, you're going, I don't know what to say. They're still talking, but I'm just trying to, what do I say to be a good pal?
Yeah.
And you're worried and you don't know what is your advice to somebody in that situation?
Mm, yeah. If they're still talking and you're finding this dialogue going on in your head going, oh, no, I don't have an answer. I don't know what to do here. Shut that dialogue down and actually just listen. You know, if you can get to that point of, you know, just listen and listen, and hear them out. Because sometimes as friends, we can listen with the answer running in our mind. I have an answer for that. If they just did this, that'd be okay. Or maybe the dismissal bit of that's not really important. So actually, if you were aware of this dialogue or the bit of panic of the dialogue going on in your head, just maybe shut it down and listen. And then when they've got it out, you can say, honestly, I don't know what to do. But if you say it genuinely or a lovely, maybe this is a question I love to be asked, but I think anybody likes to be asked, what can I do for you?
Or
what do you need from me? Do you know what I mean?
How can I help?
Rather than, well, if you did this, 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 and this, it's like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
When somebody unburdens themselves, sometimes after they unburden themselves, we actually don't know what they need. And they may not even know what they need. So.
And sometimes they just needed to say it. Rather than have somebody fix it.
That's
I remember actually speaking to Joanna Reardon last year and she said a great thing. She had a WhatsApp group with some friends and she said, you know, before a friend goes into, you know, discussing something, they'll say, is it a rant or is it advice? Because if it's a rant, we'll just let you go off, get it off your chest, all good. But if it's advice you want, fair enough, we'll give it. And I think that's a really healthy way of going about it, saying, look, it's just a rant. I just need to get this off my chest. Will you just be a sounding board for me to just talk? I don't need you to fix it.
The breakthrough in the therapy room or the breakthrough in the relationship is when the other person goes, I think they get me.
Mm.
I might reflect a sentence back or say something and they go, yeah, okay, he's got me now. He knows how I operate. Or the friend might go, I did feel listened to. They didn't judge me. They didn't offer advice straight away. They didn't dismiss what I was saying. If we could just shut down our own internal dialogue when we're with people, we'd be much more peaceful in ourselves and our friendships, I think, would function much, much better if we actually listened, really listened to each other.
Yeah.
Even the difficult person in the group, even the one who may want to dominate the group or speak the most or seems to be the most dramatic, just because what listening equals respect. Mm-hmm. And when you feel respected as a person, that is huge for you. When I feel respect from Kira as a husband, I'll go to the ends of the earth for her.
Yeah.
Absolutely go to the ends of the earth for her, and vice versa. So when you have that dynamic among your friends and either you are, some people are naturally just better listeners. I'll get that. And it's not a personality fault if you're not a good listener. There's not something wrong with you
that you need to
change. But if you can work on it going, I'll just listen. I'll give them the 10, 15 minutes. I'll give them what they need. It can be huge for deepening a friendship and just for the person to just feel better about themselves. 99% of the times when we hear ourselves talk, we actually get the solution ourselves.
Yeah.
That's what happens across the room from me.
Mm-hmm.
Just shut up, Peter, and don't jump in. Don't. You're listening to the, you're trying to read between the lines of some of what they're saying. You're trying to listen to what they're not saying in some ways. But 99% of the, there's so many times when somebody's opposite me and they're going, because, you know, when I hear myself say it now, I know what I need to do, or I know what it means. And if they can become, as you said, their own therapist and work through it themselves, I wish I wasn't busy, if you know what I mean. I wish people didn't have to come. But the job is to equip them and strengthen them to have autonomy over their own life. And I don't mean that in a selfish way, but to be able to equip themselves and have the tools to do it.
And you've hit on, and I suppose, a real fundamental aspect of therapy, which is that some people, when they don't fully get what's involved, think this is going to be the magic wand and this woman or man is going to fix me. Mm. But it's not about that. It's about you figuring it out for yourself, but somebody facilitating you to do that. And I suppose, you know, allowing them to speak, as you said, once they say it out loud, they can work it out themselves. But it's not up to the therapist to fix the person that's in front of them either. Mm-hmm. It's offering maybe perspectives or asking questions that make them think and ask them to kind of delve into it. And that was one of the things that I found quite a revelation when I started, because sometimes I wasn't necessarily hearing what I wanted to hear, but I was hearing what I needed to hear. And I sometimes leave a session going, well, that was a pile of shite.
Yeah.
And I'd go off and I'd do my thing, and then I go, all right, yeah, that's landing with me now.
Yeah.
Oh, now I get that, yeah. And I'd go back and go, you know, last week and I left here, I thought you were an awful bollocks, and I didn't get it at all. But here I am, and actually, do you know what? I had a much better week, or whatever it is. I had a really good relationship. Unfortunately, there was a lot of cursing. Really good relationship with my therapist. He was great. Still a good pal. But I'm not saying that's for everyone, but sometimes it's almost like he can sometimes lock horns as well. But that's where breakthroughs happen, is in those difficult moments.
In the therapy room, you play out your difficulties.
Yeah.
So if they have somebody who shuts them down all the time, and then they come to you and they feel you're shutting them down, let's talk about that. Me and you role play this out here. What did I do that triggered you there? Let's do it now. And they can do it in the safety of this space, because it, say this respectfully, it doesn't matter with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're going to leave me and go back into that situation. So sometimes it's really good if the therapist triggers something in you.
Mm.
That's the moment to go, do you know, you've just pissed me off there.
Yeah.
And a great therapist will go, great, why?
Yes.
But because you were just like my dad who always did this, or you're just like my sister who never let me have a word in edgeways.
Mm.
Great, tell me about your sister. Well, but, and all of a sudden, the issue, the air is taken out, the power is taken out of the situation. They've realized it, but you have been as a therapist, you can be the catalyst rather than avoiding it, going, well, okay, you know, that a good therapist will seize on those moments of resistance in the room or triggering in the room. And then there are people who just don't like what you say. Mm-hmm. I remember one or two coming in and me asking them certain questions, and what about this, what about that, and they never came back.
Yeah.
And I, as a human being, you go, crap, I got that wrong. And then you have to, in reflection, you go, no.
Trust your own process. Yeah.
I just, maybe they just didn't like, maybe I just touched the nerve and they're going, no, I'm not ready.
And maybe not ready, as you said.
Absolutely.
Not available
for it. And in 3 months' time, they might come back and go, you said that, and I'm ready now, or they might approach it a different way.
Yeah.
It's this is the beauty of the work. It's so unique to the person who sits opposite you. If I was so tunnel visioned and this is how I do my work, I wouldn't be any use to anybody. You've just got to go with what comes up in the room.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the little throwaway comment of, I know my aunt, that's another story. Tell me about the aunt.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the other story? They subconsciously are letting you in to go, I need you to ask me about the aunt, but they don't know about it. And then you go, or whatever it might be, or, oh, my time when I was away for a year. Tell me about the time away in a year. Oh, well, this happened, that happened, and I got attacked and I got beaten up. But I'm fine now. It's like, okay. Trauma's huge.
Yeah.
And a slight other tangent. Trauma is huge. We all experience it on different levels. We've all had some sort of experience where it's left a huge impression on us. And that can stay trapped inside of us. I don't want to use the word energy. It's something that is still going, traveling around inside of us.
Oh, yeah.
And it dictates a lot of our behaviors. And it needs to be released. And it can be an experience of 20 years ago. It can be words that were said to us. It's words that weren't said to us. And having the opportunity to be able to release that valve of saying what was done to us, that's half the healing. There might still need to be a journey of completing the trauma. And if it was, say, you were being pinned down and you felt, you know, you went into the freeze and you couldn't fight for yourself, part of the therapeutic process is very carefully taking that person through going, okay, feel the strength in your arms and feel you pushing them away and then see yourself running off. You complete the traumatic experience for them. And it comes to a conclusion for them because it's trapped inside. But so many experiences in our lives end up being trapped inside of us. And some people come out in serious back pain or neck pain.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be worth looking at. I wonder, is that pain or is it trauma? I've had to ask myself that question.
Yeah.
I know my work, there was a bit of wear and tear, but I've had to sit with that uncomfortableness going, I wonder if there's something else there for me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So sorry, that's just a little piece on the trauma, but...
We could have this conversation... for the next 5 hours, and I wouldn't be tired. I know I wouldn't, because you're tapping into so many different areas that I'd love to get into, but I know right now is not the time. But I'm completely with you and fascinated with that, because I do feel like, you know, as I say, the body knows the score, and you do, you know, emotional or mental trauma can manifest within the body as well in different ways. Look, I think it's given people, I hope, an insight into the value of therapy, of unloading something difficult. It doesn't have to be huge. It can be something small that's bothering you. But if you're not content in your day-to-day life, it requires a little bit of TLC. So I suppose I hope people have a better sense of the importance and value and how I suppose, practical it is for everyone to look at therapy. Do your research, find what works for you. And if you're not comfortable taking that step, well, then start with maybe opening up to friends if you're not doing so well, or family, or whatever it is. But look, none of us are perfect. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. Every one of us has stuff going on in our lives. We just don't often always talk about it. So if you're feeling isolated, alone, hurt, like you're grieving, whatever it is, you aren't on your own. You're not on your own, and there is help available, and it's important to know that.
Absolutely, 100%. I'm still working on myself. I still get triggered by things and have to sit. I have to sit in my own manure. We put manure down to really let stuff grow really, really well. It stinks for a while. It's not very pleasant. But if I sit in that awkward place for a little bit, there's gems of wisdom there for me to learn personally that equip me to live life, and I don't need that maybe to go to others. I'm equipping myself.
Yeah.
So absolutely, Sheila, you've hit the nail on the head.
You're brilliant. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people now that'll be clicking on your website link wanting to book sessions with you after listening to this conversation. Your website is byyoursidetherapy.com. I actually think I need glasses. I could barely read that. So that's your website. And thank you for making time and for allowing this to happen today. I'm delighted to have you.
Well, Sheila, it's been a pleasure. And as I said, 10 seconds can change your life. And when you reached out and we started the conversation, it felt right with me. Very much so. And I purposely didn't bring Kira or the kids in here today because they would have told you the true story. So we'll end on that positive note. They would have been going, don't go near him. You know, he's my
dad. All lies.
But no,
all
that's
lies.
All lies. No, Sheila, thank you.
Thanks,
I was
Peter.
Incredibly humbled by spending this time with you, and a real, real privilege. Thank you.
Please check the show notes for some resources which may be helpful to you. And if you like my podcast, please show your support by leaving a rating or a little comment on Apple or by clicking follow on Spotify. I'd be so thankful. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.